This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. The 2016 presidential election cycle is now fully underway, and the political landscape is awash in money like never before. As the campaigns, parties, and outside groups prepare to spend billions of dollars, with much of it raised from small groups of donors, voters from both parties are expressing cynicism about the relationship between elected officials and their patrons, and pessimism about whether the campaign finance system will ever undergo meaningful reform. In the midst of this cloud of so-called dark money, grassroots organizations on both the left and right are working to bring greater transparency and accountability to the system. Their hope is that fundamental reform of the role that money plays in our electoral process will foster a renewed sense of civic engagement among voters. Today on The Exchange, it's the role of big money in politics. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have two guests joining me for the show this morning. On the line from Auburn, Alabama, is John Pudner. John is executive director of the grassroots organization Take Back Our Republic. He previously spent almost three decades as a political campaign professional. And John, welcome to The Exchange. It's great to have you with us. John? We seem to have lost John.
Oh, happy
are you there?
Here.
Hi, good morning, now? John. Welcome.
Great, thank you.
Yep, and with me in studio here is Dan Weeks. Dan is executive director of the grassroots organization Open Democracy, which also includes the New Hampshire Rebellion. Dan, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And gentlemen, let me begin by asking each of you to frame the problem of big money in politics as you see it. Your groups come at it from different perspectives, but I see some overlap there as well. And Dan, let me start with you.
Well, thanks so much. You know, we hear a lot of talk about money in politics these days and how much is flooding our elections. But I want to suggest to you right here at the outset that we aren't really talking about money in politics or the campaign finance system, that what this is really about is whether we as a country take seriously our founding creed, which goes right back to the Declaration of Independence, this idea that all people are created equal, that when it comes to being citizens in a democracy, we are all meant to have an equal voice and that government is meant to represent all of the people. Now, we have a bug in our system today, I would suggest, where it takes a lot of money to run for office. And in the absence of any broad-based public funding of elections, we need to depend upon people with the means and the incentive to fund campaigns in order to provide that money. And what this means in practice is that a tiny fraction of 1% of Americans, and these could be liberal billionaires, conservative billionaires, I don't care who it is, but a tiny fraction of 1% of the American people provide most of the money that funds campaigns. In fact, in the last presidential election, a single billionaire provided more money than 98% of the population combined. And it's no surprise to people out there that this fraction of 1%, they may have good intentions, they may be public-spirited citizens, but their interests are different from those of most of us. I don't have the means to write these huge checks to fund campaigns, nor do most Americans. And so the interests of this tiny class of extremely wealthy people on both sides of the aisle dominate in deciding who can run for office, what they stand for, and once they get in office, what they really do for our country and whether they represent the will of the people or this tiny elite.
John, your initial thoughts.
Yes, I think our system was set up in its work because of balance, and that's the key word for us. As Dan alludes to, when the contributions are so dominantly from, you know, from so few, and that's groups as well as individuals, then the republic and the balanced republic that was set up is not functioning as well. And that's why we wanted to start with Take Back Our Republic with some conservative solutions and some positive solutions, such as how do we get more people involved in the system. For us, the best option was a tax credit to encourage many more small donors. You know, small donors are giving $356 million a year as of last cycle, and you know, with a little tax credit like we had back through both of Ronald Reagan's elections, you know, that number could easily be $1 billion. And so there's a positive way to address this balance, you know, by encouraging more citizens to participate, make it easier for them. And I think some of the election victories a few days ago that I'm sure we'll touch on later in the campaign will there. So it's balance, it's encouraging more average citizens to participate, it's making them more powerful so that their members of Congress and others have to pay attention to them, not just to a couple of large donors who don't live in their district, who they're not supposed to represent based on the system. And then at the other extreme, the things we want to start by stopping are foreign money coming into campaigns. Clearly, that wasn't supposed to be part of the balance when the system was set up. It's sort of, you know, foreign interests would be finding ways to get money in and pick our leaders. So balance would be the key word for us.
Yeah, in listening to both of you, you seem to be pointing to two dimensions to the problem. One is a suppressive effect on civic engagement and participation, and the other is this impact of kind of a distortion of policy outcomes in Congress due to access of big donors to these elected officials. Let's listen to Donald Trump at the debate this summer in August, the first Republican debate. Some people say Donald Trump kind of let the cat out of the bag.
I will tell you that our system is broken. I give to many people. Before this, before 2 months ago, I was a businessman. I give to everybody. When they call, I give. And you know what? When I need something from them, 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them. They are there for me.
And that's Donald Trump speaking at the first Republican debate on August 6th. So Dan, is that the issue, that there is evidence of an expectation of basically a quid pro quo is what Trump is talking about there?
Say it ain't so, but I think the reality is, and certainly if you poll the American people, as we've done repeatedly, as major news organizations have done, you find that the vast majority of us believe that the system is actually corrupt. That may mean good people trying to do good things, but they exist in a system where they depend upon huge money to get elected, and the money just doesn't come from you or me. It comes from people like businessman Donald Trump. And I think part of the reason that he has caught on in such a big way in this election, staying at the top of the polls for months now, is because he is talking this truth that Americans really want to hear our political leaders talk about, that the system is broken. And by saying no to super PACs, as Bernie Sanders on the left has also done, of course it's easy for him to say as a billionaire who can self-fund his campaign, he represents something different. He can say he is not beholden to anybody because he doesn't need their money.
John, your thoughts on what Donald Trump had to say about cause and effect there?
Well, I didn't know you were going to play that clip, but interestingly, I emailed that quote out to my 60,000 closest friends just moments after he said the words during that debate. I mean, I think he summed up the issue there and has, frankly, you know, to his credit, done that regularly. Now, I would say, you know, lest this sound like an endorsement of Trump's approach, while he's raised the issue, you know, his only basic solution seems to be kind of, well, if only billionaires could run, none of them could be owned, which, you know, isn't really a solution at all. So I do think he at least identified the problem there. And it really ties in. The nice thing is, I think the average person has been starting to sense this. Even 4 or 5 years ago, kind of at my Republican events when I was still running campaigns, you'd never hear money in politics or campaign finance reform being an issue. And just in the last couple of years of campaigns, I started having people say things to me like, oh, you work in politics. Now, isn't the basic deal that people in groups like give $1 million to politicians and then they get $100 million of their taxpayer money back? So I think the good opportunity here is that just in the old kind of layman's terms, people are getting what's happening, even if they don't have a precise scientific understanding of how the money's changing hands.
Yeah, and we're going to talk in a bit about Citizens United and the way that that Supreme Court decision seems to have somewhat shifted the environment a little bit. I want to let our listeners know we're talking about big money in politics today, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. And joining me in the studio now briefly is NHPR digital reporter Brian Walston. And Brian has been busy in recent months looking into the numbers on money spent in New Hampshire this presidential primary cycle. So we're going to talk about New Hampshire for a few minutes. Brian, welcome.
Good morning, Dean.
So, Brian, how much money is being spent in New Hampshire this cycle?
Well, We've looked at it through September, which was the most recent filings by the candidates. PACs filed most recently at the end of July, and they won't file again until January. So what we've got is through September. And in New Hampshire alone, it looks like about $2 million. Now, it's important to note that that doesn't include television advertising, which right. is in a whole other universe of spending as far as that goes. But right now, it looks like, for on-the-ground things, consultants, payrolls, events, different types of advertising signs and all that, it comes to about $2 million.
And what about the – do you have the figures on the campaign, on the TV ads or
yeah,
buys? Millions and millions, right?
Right. I just kind of looked at the numbers and tried to update them last night. But
sure.
Through the primary date, which is right now is February 9th, I believe,
right.
It looks like about $32 million has been reserved or spent.
Yeah.
That's subject to change, and that's going to add up to almost 18,000 ads.
Yeah. Well, listeners might not know that a lot of these campaigns actually reserve slots for ads
right.
in advance, so it basically books up. So,
and this is – yeah, and this it should be noted, this is only broadcast advertising. I mean,
right.
Cable is a little bit more difficult for someone like us to track, but – through the two New Hampshire stations and the three Boston stations that reach New Hampshire viewers, looks like about $32 million through the primary date. Now I would say, right now the Right to Rise, which is Jeb Bush's PAC or the PAC that backs him, is close to $8 million. John Kasich's two groups backing him have spent a lot on advertising, trying to get his familiarity up, his name recognition up. And, I think that helped him a little bit earlier with recognition, but I don't know how it's going.
So these purchases or these reservations really kind of reflect kind of strategic calculations about how important the state is to the campaign?
Sure, and it's kind of interesting to note that, somebody like Marco Rubio and his they were some of the first groups to come out and buy ads closer to the dates. You can see that some of the strategic decisions are to wait. There were people who spent a lot more early on than later. So we'll see, who's still in the race and who's still left to spend.
Do you see any differences between the parties? It sounds like you're mainly talking about the Republicans. Is that a function of the large field maybe?
I believe so, and they all have very active super PACs. I think by our last calculation, some 70% of the ad buys and reserves were done by PACs and three candidates, PACs it back three candidates. I think it was Bush, Christie, and Kasich controlled most of that buying.
Wow. That's amazing. So, it's interesting to me because I remember doing some research back 15 years ago or so where, the argument was there wasn't any room for these outside groups in the New Hampshire discourse, but it sounds like you're saying that most of the action now is the PACs, not the actual campaigns.
Correct.
Wow. Dan, let me get your reaction. You're here in New Hampshire. Your sense of this as well, what you're seeing on the ground.
I think this is the beginning of a real sea change in what has been so special about the New Hampshire primary. I grew up in one of our small towns in Temple and got to experience that kind of retail politics that makes New Hampshire famous, that we're celebrating now on the 100th anniversary of the New Hampshire primary. But when you have over $30 million being spent to bombard voters with often very negative attacks, if last year was any measure in the Senate race, we had over $100 million spent in 2014 just in New Hampshire. 90% of the ads were negative, and it left us sick to our stomach. It's just disgusting what is going on. And because, as Brian pointed out, most of the money being spent is not by the candidates themselves, where you would expect at least a little bit of accountability. They're going to want to represent themselves positively when it's these ostensibly independent groups, these super PACs, where literally one or a handful of billionaires can come in and set up a group supporting a candidate or opposing his or her opponents. They'll run the worst kind of political ads that often drive people away from the polls. You know, in the last presidential primary here in New Hampshire, again, a state that I'm proud to be from, where we have this strong tradition of political engagement, turnout in the last presidential primary in New Hampshire as a percentage of the voting age public was just a little bit over 10%. In other years, it's been maybe in the 20s, but it's very low. In last fall's election in the midterm, we had the lowest turnout since the 1940s, when we were in the midst of World War II. So we are seeing some real effects. This huge flood of independent money is making voters really disgusted with the political process and, I think, driving down participation.
Yeah. Brian, Mike from Lee emailed us, and he wants to know, is anybody tracking money spent on internet ads? Seems to be a lot out there.
You know, that's that's a little bit more difficult to track. I mean, I think we'd like to take a closer look at that. You can see some of that in the spending by the candidates themselves, although we haven't broken that category out. That tends to show up a little bit more. I mean, you can see that in their spending reports to the FEC versus, yeah. You know, television ads are tracked differently. They're paid for through different funds and through two different people. So you don't see those in the spending reports. But, you know, I don't think there's any doubt that there are more and more of that every year. You're going to continue seeing that.
My daughter told me the other day anytime she watched a YouTube video, she was seeing Marco Rubio before she got to watch her YouTube video.
Right.
John, your sense of what you're seeing on the ground, the cycle in terms of the expenditure activity.
Well, I think Dan's right on the problem, the negativity being driven by most of the money coming through these third parties, PACs, C4s, C6s, not to get into technical terms. And part of the problem here is that all the incentive is for larger donors to give through third party. I mean, when you get in a federal race, you've got a $2,700 limit on direct contributions, but you can give unlimited, and often it's easier to hide money given third party. It's very clear if you're giving to a candidate. And so this is part of the big problem we've seen, and that's why you have, you know, 80% of some of these campaigns and around the country, not just presidential, are third party. The candidate's not allowed to speak to the PAC running ads, but they can certainly introduce their donors to them and get them to give. And as Dan alluded to, this increases negativity because there's no accountability for the campaign. When I used to sit there as a consultant for 20 years, and we thought we had to go after an opponent, but it was being run by the campaign, we were much more careful. Now, is this a legitimate attack? Is this based on the record? Is everything factual? We can't have any mistakes because this will look so bad for our candidate if we launch an attack that just looks shrill or is inaccurate. God forbid that can, you know, frankly end your campaign, a false attack. And you'd be very careful. Well, now when you've got a third party, which the candidate can stand up and say, I can't talk to them, they're independent, they want to be as shrill and as hard-hitting, and as because right. When you attack, it raises the negatives of both the one being attacked and the attacker. Well, if the being attacked is one of the candidates and the attacker is people who really, really love New Hampshire, PAC, you know, which is just a made-up name, you know, then they don't care if they're negative, if the group negatives go up. So we do think some kind of package that says we've got to be tighter on disclosure of this third-party giving. And if that means upping that $2,700 limit, you know, to encourage at least more of the money to go through campaigns, we're all for that kind of trade-off.
And, Brian, we're just about to go to a break, but real quick, Trump and Carson leading New Hampshire, not spending a lot of money.
No, Carson has spent less than $200,000 on advertising so far. I don't think Trump has run an ad in New Hampshire, although I think he might have one in Iowa. I'm not sure.
Well, Brian, thanks so much coming in here and joining us. We appreciate it. That's Brian Walston, NHPR's digital reporter. We'll be back with lots more on campaign finance and money in politics. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're looking at the debate around campaign finance. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. Joining me for the show today are Dan Weeks. He's executive director of Open Democracy, an advocacy group working to get money out of politics, and John Pudner, executive director of Take Back Our Republic, a group focusing on conservative solutions to campaign finance. Gentlemen, we're going to go to the phones in a moment, but first I want to play a little bit of sound from Bernie Sanders in a recent interview talking about this issue of why people make big donations to campaigns.
If you're going to contribute $1 million to my super PAC, well, maybe you're a hell of a nice guy and you like to participate. Or maybe you want something. I think you want something. And you and I are going to become really good buddies so I can do your bidding. In other words, the millionaire class and the billionaire class increasingly own the political process, and they own the politicians who go to them for money.
That's Bernie Sanders speaking in a July interview with Ezra Klein, who's the editor of the news website Vox. And, gentlemen, let's go to the phones, and we have Keith joining us from Bedford. Keith, welcome to The Exchange.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to call in and thank all of you guys involved, first and foremost, for speaking about this issue, basically because people who have cable or turn on the radio, all they hear is these political ads, and kind of hard to know what to think and who you can trust. So just to get this issue out there and expose people to the issue of dark money, I think goes a long way in getting people to the polls and letting people know what the issues are, because the issue of campaign finance reform or money in politics really is the issue that controls all other issues. And if we don't do something about this, then we're never going to get a fair election.
Yeah, and Dan, I'm going to go to you on that. But first, I want to mention, you had Brian Walston here in the previous segment, the NHPR digital reporter. You can find all of his research on money and politics in New Hampshire at the website nhpr.org. So, Dan, your response to Keith.
Thanks, Dean. I think Keith raised a really important point. You know, I didn't come to this issue by waking up one morning thinking campaign finance reform is where it's at. I came to this, like probably most people, because I was concerned about other issues that really affect my daily life. You know, growing up in Temple, New Hampshire, in a small town, spending a lot of time outdoors, I came to think of myself as an environmentalist. I wanted to make sure that we preserve what is beautiful about New Hampshire. I got to spend my summers up in the White Mountains in the north country of our state. And you take that issue in particular. We've been debating now for about 5 years this issue of Northern Pass. Will we erect these 155-foot transmission lines to cut through protected lands that are such a signature of New Hampshire? And when you actually dig into these issues, when you start to follow the money, you discover that on issue after issue, certain views that are often widely supported by the general public but may be against the interests of a very well-placed, politically active and well-funded set of interests, those publicly supported policies are often not given a real fair chance. And so on the Northern Pass issue, this has been the number one issue that's been lobbied on in New Hampshire in terms of the amount of money spent by those wanting to implement the Northern Pass plan, contributing thousands of dollars to political campaigns, spending over $500,000 lobbying our state government. And on this and so many other issues, Americans feel like their interests simply aren't being represented because money plays such a huge role in the process.
And I should mention, we just listened to Bernie Sanders, and Bernie supporters are emailing us. Bill emailed in, Bernie Super PAC is We the People. And Nancy from Putney says to highlight Bernie's unwillingness to accept corporate contributions. He doesn't have a super PAC, and also he's strongly opposed to Citizens United. So we thank you for emailing in. John, let me turn to you. I want to go back to our earlier discussion about the sort of twin impacts of policy outcomes and civic engagement and participation. Now, you're someone who's made the argument that the issue, you know, money is one thing, but the issue here is the sort of suppression of political participation. And I'm wondering, is there any kind of empirical evidence out there or anything that you've seen that sort of shows that this is in fact the case, that the more money there is, the less kind of the more sort of voter cynicism and lack of participation? Because there are a number of reasons why people don't vote.
Sure. I'd come back to balance a little. I think the reason we've seen these terrible turnouts the last couple elections is just a sense that the voter has, you know, everything's kind of bought and paid for. There's, you know, it's a few big donors. I think you just look at the fall off in the last presidential, where, you know, both parties received millions of fewer votes in the election, and certainly the last congressional elections as well. Dan referred to the lowest turnout since World War II, when a lot of people were obviously overseas for the election, and that was nationwide. In addition to being in New Hampshire, I do think that some of these things, that the tax credits, where they have been used in Virginia and Oregon and Ohio, you know, turnout has clearly gone up. Now, obviously, a couple of those states are battleground states, and you know, they sorting out, you know, cause and effect can be a little difficult, but certainly there's been, I think, a greater participation where these kind of efforts have been made. Even just the symbolic nature of saying, hey, we care about you, the average person, and would like you to be able to give the first $100, $200 you're going to give to the IRS to picking the, you know, a candidate or cause of your choice. I mean, just doing that, I think, says, hey, we want you back involved in this process.
Yeah, and Dan, I'm interested in your thoughts as well, because, you know, my sense is there's a lot of money spent. A lot of it seems to just kind of be wasted, but both you and John are suggesting that there were kind of real impacts on whether or not people decide to vote. I mean, the Donald Trump argument we've heard about for many years, but this other issue of a suppression of engagement, I think, is an interesting one, and I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe I can give a little example that comes to mind. I've been working on this issue for a long time, but a couple of years ago I had the chance to take a little sabbatical and travel around the country on Greyhound buses on a poverty line budget, wanting to look at more of the human consequences of this system and how ordinary folks, especially people in poverty — there's close to 50 million Americans living below the poverty line today — how they view politics and what they see as their ability to have a voice. And to give just one example of countless people I met along the way, a fellow here in New Hampshire by the name of Vinny, who's a computer programmer by trade, who you might say made a mistake in love, although I hesitate to describe it in that way. But his girlfriend, as so many other Granite Staters we've seen lately, has an opioid addiction. And they were driving one day with some illegal prescriptions, and they were pulled over, and both of them spent a year in prison. A year later, when I interviewed Vinny, he had recently been released. He was homeless because he, on account of his conviction, had difficulty getting a job, putting his skills as a computer programmer to use. And I started to ask him, once we'd talked a little bit about his situation, how he viewed politics and whether he was going to vote and thought that it was worth his while. Now, he actually said to me outright that he was legally excluded from voting, that he'd lost the right to vote because of his conviction. As a matter of fact, he was wrong there, because in New Hampshire, unlike a lot of other states, you do regain the right to vote once you've served time. A lot of states disenfranchise people even for life. But even though Vinny thought that he couldn't vote, when I asked him then about, you know, having his voice heard, influencing the political process, he said, heck with it. It isn't worth my time because it's all about the money. And that refrain, it's all about the money, is something I heard verbatim from countless people all across the country, in New Hampshire, all the way to California, who felt that it just wasn't even worth trying to participate in politics, because the chance that their voice could be heard in a system that relies on private money from literally a fraction of 1% of very wealthy Americans just didn't make sense. It wasn't a rational use of their time. And I think that is a widespread view, not just among people in poverty. And evidence for this comes from a recent Princeton study, which looks at the stated interests in decades worth of public opinion polling of the general population, the bottom 90%, as compared with the top 10% of so-called affluent Americans. And according to this, this is the most comprehensive political science analysis ever conducted of representation in Washington. They find that when the interests of the vast majority of us, liberal or conservative, the bottom 90%, diverge from the interests of the top 10%, that the bottom 90%, the vast majority of us, exert a, quote, near zero, statistically non-significant impact on public policy. And I think this is, unfortunately, something that the vast majority of us already believe is true, and people like Vinny don't even bother to try because they think it's not going to make any difference.
And John, I'm going to come back to you on this in a moment, but first we're joined by Steve Missler. Steve is a State House bureau chief for the Portland Press Herald, and on Election Day, Maine approved an expansion of its clean election reforms. And Steve, we appreciate you joining us. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thanks for having me, Dean.
Sure. Could you give us a little background? What is Maine's history with this type of reform? I think it goes back to 96. Is that correct?
That's right. In 96, there was a citizen-led effort to establish a public campaign financing system for legislative and gubernatorial candidates. And that went into effect in 2001 and has been in place ever since. Over the years, the program had seen very strong participation, particularly among legislative candidates. There were 85% of legislative candidates in 2008 used the program. And the program basically works. What you do if you're a candidate, you go around and you collect several $5 or small dollar donations to qualify for a lump sum of money for your primary, and then another, you have to go around and do that again for your for the general election contest. And the theory behind it is that it would attract a wide array of different candidates, not just those who have or either wealthy enough to self-fund their campaigns, or those who have the connections to go out and solicit private donations. That's the theory behind it, and also that I think that that those small dollar donations, if you collect them from the public, that you are perhaps more responsive to more people. The program has withstood a couple of big hits. One was Citizens United, which opened the faucet of outside money in Maine. And all over the country, and this was especially true in state elections, gubernatorial and legislative elections, and they've shattered records every year since Citizens United, and that was last year we had $14 million in gubernatorial and legislative spent on legislative and gubernatorial elections, which shattered the previous record set in 2012. And then in the previous one in 2010. And that's all by outside groups. And in fact, last year, the spending actually was more than the candidates themselves combined, what they spent on their own races. So so the Clean Elections program has been hit since the Supreme Court ruling on Citizens United. And then a second ruling that eliminated or outlawed it's called a matching funds provision, which allowed a candidate who was running, a clean elections candidate who was running in a race, to receive more money if his opponent or an outside group came in and outspent them. The Supreme Court ruled that that was unconstitutional and, you know, was effectively a freeze on free speech. And since then, the participation rate in clean elections has gone down to 51% in 2014, so from 85 to 51%. That's probably a lot of background for you, but what we have now that just passed last week is was an initiative to increase the amount of money available to clean elections candidates, and the idea is to sort of help replace the loss of the loss of matching funds, which helped them sort of fend off attacks by outside groups.
Right. So
I was reading a little bit of your work on this, and it sounds like, I mean, current cycle, this getting this expansion through. There was some criticism of the groups who were working to get money out of politics because they actually ended up taking a fair bit of money from outside of the state. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. In fact, it was almost most of it. I mean, 80% of the funding that they received came from outside of Maine. And I think, you know, the proponents of the initiatives pointed to the number of small dollar donations that they received in state. But the vast majority of the money that they spent, or they received, I should say, came from outside of Maine. And I think that's because this public campaign financing is actually something that's being discussed on the federal level. Lawrence Lessig, if you recall, was a Democratic candidate. This was a central issue in his platform. And this is, I believe, on the left, I think this is what they view as a solution to this this flood of outside money, and I think what you saw is a lot of the people, whether they're progressive donors like Pat Stryker from Colorado, who's the Harris of Stryker Corp. She donated $50,000 to the campaign in Maine. J.J. Abrams, you know, director of the new Star Wars movie, donated $50,000. There was a nonprofit in Amherst, Massachusetts, that donated $550,000, and that has links to the Soros Foundation. So this, so they were criticized for this, but their response was, "Look, we need this. Is what we feel that this is a solution to a problem that we couldn't achieve without side of overturning Citizens United, which would require constitutional convention."
It's the unilateral disarmament argument.
Correct,
John. We're up here in New England, Maine, and New Hampshire. You're down in Alabama. Do you see anything like this down in your neck of the woods?
Not here specifically. You know, the other big election victories, I think, for money in politics were, you know, San Francisco and Seattle. Obviously, had ballot initiatives that were also successful. So if you looked at three in the country, Maine was one of three right there. And I would, you know, defend the Maine organizations on that. Ironically, I was driving out to meet with some of them almost a year ago, and your snow was so high there I couldn't get there. So, so I'm glad you're having nicer weather this year. But the neat thing is, I think that Maine victory creates a lot of momentum. And not to say we particularly specifically, you know, for, I don't know if we're for every item in there, but certainly as far as the general thrust and winning and wanting to address money in politics. And I think the couple other elections that were important, I think, ironically, the Ohio vote on legalizing drugs was a big one for money and the influence in politics. I know that sounds odd. What's the connection? You know, there you had whatever your feelings on legalizing drugs are.
This is for our listeners, this is the vote in Ohio to legalize marijuana. Correct?
Absolutely. Yep. This was a perfect example of money in politics. People didn't realize that. You basically, you've got some big companies who would benefit from wherever drugs are legalized, and they have business models that include things such as what percentage of people will become addicts. So how many Vinnies will they be, as, you know, Dan referred to Vinny there, you know, and coming out on the other side of that. And so that's part of a business model. So in Ohio, what you had is, you know, several people, in essence, part of this kind of this political industrial complex, as they call it, putting lots of money in to pass a legalized marijuana bill, but that also had all kinds of neat provisions, like there were only 10 farms it could be grown on, and house products. I mean, they were almost creating a near monopoly on how to make money off this process, and that's the example where the giving is transactional.
John, I need to jump in. We have one more break, and I do want to say thanks to Steve Missler from the Portland Press Herald. We really appreciate you joining us this morning, Steve. Thanks.
Thanks.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today we're talking about the debate on campaign finance reform. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And I have two guests joining me for the remainder of the show. Dan Weeks, Executive Director of Open Democracy, an advocacy group working to get money out of politics, and John Pudner, Executive Director of Take Back Our Republic, a group focusing on conservative solutions to campaign finance. And let's go to the phones. We've got a number of people calling in this morning. And let's say hi to Steve in Portsmouth. Steve, welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, hello. How you doing? And hello to your guests. Yeah, I just want to make one comment on this issue that I don't think many people make, is that I think the money and the election side of politics, the election side, the money that's actually distributed within Congress once they get in, I understand the two are related. But I think on the election side, money is more of what backfills the void created by not having people that are saying anything that help the people. In other words, it's money isn't the problem. It's the result of the problem. For instance, earlier in the show, you were talking about how Dr. Carson was, and I'm not advocating any candidate, but how he spent a ridiculously small amount of money so far and has gotten pretty much to be the top guy or close to the top of the Republican campaign. So I think it's really just the fact that we don't have any people that in politics that are inspiring the constituents, and it's just creating sort of a malaise, and the money is being pumped in. And one other quick comment on this. If you have person A and person B, and person B wants to spend millions of dollars looking, you know, making themselves look like a fool, that doesn't in any way suppress person A from getting their message out. So I think this whole issue is a distraction. And the real problem is we just don't have anyone in politics that's saying anything that helps the people.
Wow, very interesting. John, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, one of my last campaigns I launched last year was Dave Bratt's big upset of Eric Cantor, the majority leader in Virginia. And you know, Dave ended up spending $200,000 against $5 million. The media's favorite stat on that was that Cantor had spent more in steakhouses than Bratt spent on his entire campaign, which we thought was interesting. But I think Steve's right. What we had there was Bratt inspired, you know, a couple hundred people to knock on doors, to make phone calls, to be involved. I mean, you would have almost thought it was a New Hampshire campaign for the amount of, you know, attention people were getting from Dave and his supporters. And so there, yeah, I think he's right, and that void's often not there. And if no one's engaged and no one's out there, yeah, I think Steve's right. Then the default kind of becomes money. Well, the only way you're going to reach them is to pay for advertising. So I think he's right on.
Steve, thanks for that call. Dan, I want to listen a little bit to Lawrence Lessig, who's been involved with the New Hampshire Rebellion and Open Democracy, ran briefly for the presidency. And let's listen to him speaking with NPR's Michelle Martin after he ended his Democratic presidential campaign about why he was so heavily focused on campaign finance. And I'm going to ask you a related question.
Well, nobody's surprised by the fact that it's Congress that is the failed institution in our government. You know, it has a single-digit approval rating. And the reason it's the failed institution in our democracy is, one, because of the way they fund their campaigns. You know, they spend 30 to 70% of their time raising money from the tiniest fraction of the 1%. So when they say they're representative, they're not representative of us because they're so concerned about how to raise the money to get back to Congress or to get their party back into power.
That's Lawrence Lessig speaking with NPR's Michelle Martin, talking about his presidential bid and campaign finance. And Dan, I want to ask you about just the whole strategy of the New Hampshire Rebellion. Anne from Gilmanton emailed in talking about Granny D. Doris Haddock, the founder of Open Democracy, who we know walked across the country for campaign finance. The Rebellion and Larry Lessig have walked all over New Hampshire. But there's more money than ever before in politics. So I guess my question is, what's the strategy behind the Rebellion and sort of the walking, and how does that translate into actual sort of reform?
Thank you. Well, I think we've established so far in the program that there is a problem out there. How do we solve it? And this is something that here in New Hampshire, we've gone back to basics, if you will, to one of those most basic democratic arts of protesting peacefully, nonviolently for an important cause. And And just to mention Granny D again, she's someone who I got to meet as a high school kid at Conval High School and who really inspired me to join this movement when she, at the age of 90, walked across America 3,200 miles in 1999 and 2000 to bring this issue to the fore. And so we decided a couple of years ago, with a lot of leadership from Professor Lawrence Lessig, as well as folks far to the right of him, that we needed to go back to basics. We needed to actually take to the streets and put ourselves out there in a way that can help to force this issue into the debate. We find that in a poll we conducted right at the outset, 96% of Americans agree with us that money in politics is a problem, but 91% have very little hope that it can be addressed. So how do we overcome that lack of hope? And that has led us to take to the streets, not just once or twice in the middle of winter. We've done these long walks, which Lawrence
got a lot of coverage up here, yeah.
Was a leader of in January of 2014 and again January of this year, walking a combined 30,000 miles with people coming from all around New Hampshire and from other states to walk. We've continued these walks on Patriots Day on July 4th and throughout the year, including just last Thursday in Manchester when we marched to all of the presidential campaign offices in Manchester to deliver our new We the People pledge. And the whole concept behind this is that we need to make this not just one on a long issue of concerns, and there are a lot of important issues in this election, but we need to show the presidential candidates that this is the first issue, that they're not going to be able to solve the slew of other issues that they promised to solve until they address this issue of the corruption of our democracy by big money in politics.
So you guys are basically setting the table for dealing with this issue down the road. It sounds like, you know, the visibility, letting the candidates know this is the key issue. Let's go back to the phones. We have Michelle joining us from Concord. Michelle, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd just like to say in reference to what the last speaker just spoke of on the phone, so I can't really hear my radio at the same time, but also in reference to somebody named Vinny that was mentioned earlier, I want to say nothing ever changes if people don't insist on change. So if you say I don't vote because my vote doesn't matter or it's all about the money or what have you, then that's the way it's always going to be. Americans that don't vote, unless you're completely off the grid or whatever it is and you don't need any sort of social services or you're completely not involved in the community at all, nothing's ever going to change. These people generally wonder why the services aren't in place when they don't do anything to make things change. And then they continue to support the corporations that fund what they supposedly are keeping them lazy or disinterested in the system to begin with. I think people in other countries of the world, or I see this, are laying down in traffic, walk miles, and protest, and often die for the right to vote that we take for granted here in this country. So if you say nothing is ever going to change, it's not going to unless you insist on it.
And Michelle, thanks for calling in from Concord with those thoughts. And let's now go to Jonathan in Manchester. Jonathan, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Money in politics is the number one issue of our politics today. Political reform, to get political reform through. The perception is it's a left or right issue, but it's an issue on the left as well as the right. Yesterday, a 501c3 that was a grassroots organization, very supported by a lot of people, League of Conservation Voters, they came out in support of Hillary Clinton. And I tried to find out why, because so many of the people I read online were Bernie Sanders supporters. And it turns out that last year they were playing the black money organization because they're influenced politically how many candidates they were able to influence. And basically they decided that Bernie's campaign would not respond to their needs. So they decided prematurely to support Hillary, and it wigged out most of their base supporters. Their rating online went from a 5 to a 2.3 yesterday, very swiftly in one day of criticism. And so it corrupts instantly when you look at the fact that they're looking just for a simple exchange.
Jonathan,
buy yourself a seat.
Yeah, well, Jonathan, let's go to our guest now. Jonathan raises an interesting question. He talks about left and right, also we just received an email from Robin, and Robin's also sort of presenting kind of a conservative argument that the problem is actually expanding government that's leading to increased political expenditure. So, John, your organization is sometimes characterized as having conservative solutions. solutions. You have a somewhat different view on Citizens United. Your sense of how this plays on the political right.
Absolutely. I think disclosure is so central here because a lot of this cynicism is, you know, people not even being able to see who's paying money that's leading to results, whether it be on how a, you know, 501c3, 4, whatever, endorses, you know, the example that was just given. We have a bill that's about to go into Congress on requiring that credit card contributions be verified. And part of the reason for that is starting in 08, it was President Obama's campaign that first did it, but Republicans and Democrats have done it since then. They stopped even requiring that an address be verified on credit card contributions, meaning you don't really know if it's contributions coming from overseas, where it's coming from. And there are all kinds of other disclosure issues where people are giving up because they don't know who's paying for these things. It's harder to find. Dan gave the example kind of, you know, the environmental coming from more of a progressive perspective. And,
right.
You know, I've worked with farm bureaus, for example, who in my past life before this, who, you know, would say, hey, they believe the EPA is over-aggressive or, you know, same as maybe the coal industry or someone. And I'll give you an example of disclosure of why conservatives should be concerned is, you know, at one point, Tom Steyer, the biggest political donor in the country, started putting a lot of money into kind of the war on coal. Now, you may agree with that, you may not, but in talking to some researchers, they wanted to point out that Steyer was behind all this giving to what, you know, looked like just environmental causes. It took them 18 months to connect the dots. I mean, elections were being held and gone. And my point is, Steyer's free to give. He's the biggest public giver, too. You know, but if I can sit there, if Dan and I can sit there and both look at a candidate and say, oh, you know, Tom Steyer's putting all this money into this effort, hey, maybe I usually agree with Tom and feel like he's an environmentalist, or maybe from the right I'm suspicious because he has alternate energy companies and that's how he makes his money. You know, at least the voter can make their case there. And someone on the left would say the same thing about the Koch brothers, you know. Mm-hmm. So if people are giving ideologically, you know, that's one thing, but when you can at least connect dots and put it in front of the voters and say, okay, look, there's no real way in the Citizens United vote to limit money, to cut it out right now, but can we at least know who's flooding the money in so we can all make a judgment on whether or not we support the agenda being funded by this major donor?
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, thanks for that call. Dan, we have a few minutes left, and I want to give both you and John a chance to kind of give us your final thoughts, but sort of your response, and also, so you get everyone's attention with the events and the walking. What's next for you?
Yeah, well, I want to just pick up on this,
sure.
You know, solutions to this problem.
Absolutely.
Because a lot of people are pretty hopeless at this point in the conversation, you know.
There seems to be agreement that there's a problem on both sides.
Absolutely. Okay. And John picked up on one really important one, and we'd put that right at the top of the list. That is full immediate transparency of this spending. I don't care if it's a liberal or a conservative billionaire. It needs to be out in the light of day. John also mentioned a reform earlier, which we think is absolutely critical, and another example where people on all sides can come together. And this is the main example. Maine is one example of how this can be done. But basically moving from a system where we have big money from a few funding our politics to a system where we have small money from many, a really small donor empowerment incentive program. And it could be done through a voucher, through a tax incentive like John described. It could be done through the Maine model where you provide a matching fund or a grant for candidates who show they're legitimate by raising a large number of small donations. That's another crucial reform. I would mention another important reform, and these are all part of the new We the People pledge, an agenda that we're demanding the presidential candidates support in these last 3 months of the New Hampshire primary.
Six items.
Core reforms, exactly. So we've got the transparency. We've got citizen-funded elections, this small donor empowerment. We also need to do something about this unlimited, unregulated money that's flooding in after Citizens United. A recent poll from Bloomberg found that 80% of Republicans and 83% of Democrats want Citizens United overturned. You could do that through appointing just one new Supreme Court justice to undo that jurisprudence, or you could pass a constitutional amendment. And recently here in New Hampshire, the state Senate passed SB 136 unanimously. Every Republican and every Democrat, and this calls on Congress to amend the Constitution as 16 other states have done. And the pressure now goes to the House here in New Hampshire. Will they also approve SB 136 to call on Congress, as 69 New Hampshire towns have also demanded that they do? So these are a couple of the reforms.
Right.
But I would also mention that you've got to do something about voter access as well. And I think the earlier caller, Michelle, made an important point. People need to take responsibility, but it's also our responsibility to remove barriers, to ensure that politicians aren't picking the voters through gerrymandering. And also,
we've done entire shows on gerrymandering. That's another whole can of worms. John, we've got about a minute and a half, maybe a little less left. I want to give you the final word. What are you looking to in the future with your organization?
Yeah, we're going to try to balance the seesaw. The more donors we get, small donors, average voters, citizens, and then the more we can stop foreign money in particular, disclose big money that is legitimate but can be disclosed. You know, when Marshall Coleman ran for governor of Virginia years ago, he had eight people give him $1 million each. The key to that story is he lost. People didn't like the idea that eight developers were giving money at a time when they were worried about traffic. I'm not advocating that people should give $1 million to candidates, but saying that the disclosure can handle a lot of this. And with disclosure, we also want a package law that says you also can't take employment retribution against someone for giving. We want them disclosed, but we also don't want people unfairly attacked for giving money too. That's all part of getting people more involved in the process.
Well, we are unfortunately, we're just about out of time, and I think we're all going to be watching to see whether there's any reform in the campaign finance system. You all have done a great job of kind of pointing out what the problem is, and we're going to look to see if some of these solutions that you all have mentioned move towards fruition in coming election cycles. I'd like to thank my guests for joining us this morning. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. That's John Pudner, executive director of the grassroots organization Take Back Our Republic. John joined us from Auburn, Alabama. And Dan, thanks so much for coming into the studio this morning.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dan Weeks, executive director of Open Democracy, which also includes the New Hampshire Rebellion. I'd also like to thank NHPR digital reporter Brian Walston and Portland Press Herald State House Bureau Chief Steve Missler, who joined us earlier in the program. I also want to mention that NHPR's Brian Walston and Daniel Barrick have done extensive reporting on campaign spending and political money. You can find all of those stories, and I highly recommend them, on NHPR.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski Larson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.